This is Jason Horsey with the Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. This week I am talking to Anne Diamond, a last minute arrangement. Just so I wouldn't let you all down. This is the second book, or this is part two, and The Man Next Door is part one?
I think it's part two.
But it's going to be a separate book.
I guess so. You know, when I pull it all together, I mean, there's hundreds of pages, I think, of files, and I'm just unable to even get to the point of pulling them together, you know, at this point. Just I haven't even tried, you know, so. And things keep happening, so it always feels as though, oh, I'll have to take another, you know, look at this from another angle and pull it all together. You know, it's like I really don't want to go on and on about it. I want to finish it. It's become a big obstacle somehow. But anyway, so that's where it's at. If you want to talk about it, I mean, It does relate to this subject of the maid, you know.
Well, yeah, I'll get to that in a second. I was just going to say that it's kind of parallel in what you're expressing with my experience with John DeRuiter, because it's been 7 years since I started that book, and I'm finally, well, hopefully today it'll, because there's even been technical problems at the 11th hour, just trying to get it actually through the Amazon system and published. But the aim is to get it published on his 58th birthday, which is 2 days from now, and that's made it extra sort of finickety, actually, just getting the timing exactly right. But the main obstacle has just been getting the book ready and just feeling like it was the right time for various different reasons, one of them being the possibility of being sued and legal action, and just wanting to feel like I was on solid enough ground if that was going to happen. But anyway, the parallel there in terms of that feeling of, why can't I find closure with this? Why do I have to keep returning to it? You know?
Yeah. Yes, I know that well. Mm. Well, because, you know, you're intricately entwined with the subject, you know. Mm. So anyway.
Yeah, and it's, for me, it's been like, I mean, the process of writing about it is a disentangling. So then, it's releasing it. I want releasing it to be, obviously, I can't consciously control this, but I can try and be in tune with it. I want releasing the book to be timed with the final disentanglement, so by the time the book's actually out there, I'm not entangled anymore, and therefore that reduces the possibility of some unwelcome backlash.
Oh, you mean if you are disentangled, you'd be less vulnerable if you're disentangled, is that what you're saying?
Not less vulnerable exactly, but less, well, I suppose it's not so much about avoiding any backlash, although I think that would be a side effect, but that the actual finished result is clear and clean. It doesn't have all these hooks and these personal agendas in it. I'm just doing it in a way that's more or less clean, and therefore that would also reduce the chances of undesired consequences, I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's the same. I don't know if they're parallel. They're parallel, but I don't know if they're identical situations. But, I'm sort of just working towards somehow. anyway, not forgiving, but maybe it is forgiving, you know. Anyway, I'm working towards that. I think I'm very vulnerable to the, I mean, you don't have to, you're not dealing with someone who's world famous, popular, beloved, you know, figure that everyone, I mean, anyway, it's very difficult. We're right in the middle of this month of Leonard Cohen celebrations in Montreal. That makes it a bit more poignant.
Right.
I would like to finish this book. And of course, I'm the only person who doesn't like him. Well, no, I'm not. I actually love him, but, you know, and it's, but it's really entangled and dense. There's something to unravel, you know. Still, I'm still, like, I was feeling, I had a terrible feeling just a couple of hours ago. Maybe it was just something I ate, but anyway. It's, anyway, we're in the middle of a month of celebrations. Leonard Cohen, the anniversary of his death was 2 days ago. So they're, you know, they've had all these, they've had the big concert with Sting and, you know, K.D. Lang and all these people. And now, almost daily, there's some sort of event tied into him, to his, either his music or his, or something, you know, his writing. I went to a talk by Sylvie Simmons, the biographer, the other day.
Mm-hmm.
The English event was sold out. I had to go in French, and she wasn't all that articulate in French, but she struggled through, you know. Anyway, that was interesting. So they just have one thing after another.
Mm-hmm.
On this huge wall, these wall murals that are being dedicated or inaugurated or whatever. And in one of them, he's making, you know, a Masonic hand signal. And it's, all of it I find quite creepy. You know, he's really been enshrined, and they're just talking about him all the time, and it's becoming a huge cliche, and all of that. You know, sort of sit and watch that happening.
Right. Yeah, well, the I mean, what sort of sparked this conversation today was because I was having the exchange at Facebook, and that was in the group that was a private group that have gathered together around John DeRuiter, or rather around the recognition that he's not what he seems. So it's actually a group that's geared towards exactly what you're doing, which is the dissolving of an illusion around a public figure, and the, you know, the getting free of a cult of personality, that whole dynamic. And this guy that I had the exchange with is the guy who set the group up. So he's absolutely committed to busting the illusion of John DeRuiter's goodness, but his reaction to your stuff was ironic in that regard, because he came back saying that Leonard Cohen is a wise, sweet, humble man with an authentic heart. He's a truly good person, and this, that, and the other. I don't need to read any of this because I know Leonard.
Everyone knows that.
And I mean, yeah, you'd expect that from a Leonard Cohen fan, but not from somebody who's part of a group that's, you know, focusing on the peccadilloes of a guru and is so familiar with that kind of reaction from the followers of the guru, which is basically, don't tell me anything bad about John because I know that he's perfect goodness. He was actually echoing those sentiments himself, and so it was a difficult situation, of course, trying to delicately point out, without, you know, making the situation worse, that, well, nobody's immune to cults of personality. No one's immune to hero worship and to a kind of suspension of the logical faculties when we have strong feelings about someone. So that's what happened, right? But I think he's recognized his own reactions and is probably reconsidering at this point a little bit.
Well, you know, it's, I was just seeing people now, you know, it's this whole it's partly an issue of scapegoating, hero worship, raising someone up, and then tearing them down, or tearing down someone who's a bit like them, so that you can avoid tearing your idol down, but you can tear some other idol down. You know, and what's going on in Hollywood now with Kevin Spacey's the latest one. You know, they're going to just remove him from. They're going to get rid of him. They're going to erase him, I think. They're going to reshoot the series that he's in, House of Cards, without him.
What? You mean the old episodes or just the latest season, I presume?
The latest season, I guess they can't, you know. But they would like to just, you know, get rid of. I mean, they're going to. It's like Stalin and knocking over the statues of the great leaders when you have the revolution. I mean, I think that's utterly ridiculous in the first place, because I know he's a scapegoat. You know, I'm sure he did all the things that they say he did, but so did so many others that they're not going to get around to. Mm. Because I think if they did, they'd get everybody. And there just wouldn't be a Hollywood, you know?
Yeah, well, it sends the message that the system itself is pure. There's a few rotten apples. So if we remove all traces of Kevin Spacey, then this is the same with Jimmy Savile, of course. It's actually an overreaction to communicate the message that the system is responding, because the system isn't like that.
Right. Well, that's what people are not going to, you know, people are not going to be divided, and the few who know that it doesn't matter who you are or what your moral makeup is, they will get you. And if they don't, and if you don't comply, they will get rid of you before you get your foot in the door, or, you know, you will be eliminated one way or another. You'll just be ignored, or you'll be dropped, or you'll be worse, killed, or something will happen to you if you stand up to them. So some of us know that. I mean, I think I know that. I think I know that to be true. It's partly because I've known Leonard, because really I don't care about Hollywood, but I don't care to study all this stuff. I've just ended up knowing it, but because of him mainly. But then, you know, that's one group that understands that. The majority of people, though, are ready to go along with the idea that we'll get rid of, you know, Bill Cosby and whatever. We'll humiliate a few people, but things will just roll along as if nothing happened. But, you know, the whole system, I think, is based on abuse, pedophilia. And it's not, because the money at the top makes sure of that. You know, they run it that way. I don't think it's because the human nature is that way, or that, you know, I think it's because there's a conscious control operating, you know, and that keeps it that way. It's an old tradition. But anyway, you know, so you comply or you die, and that's it. You know, I just find it so ironic watching it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I really don't, you know, I'm not out to, I don't know if you're out to get John DeRuiter, but I'm not out to, I'm really, I don't feel like I'm out to get Leonard. That's not my
conscious intent. Well, that's not your conscious intent, but I mean, this is the thing that I was addressing with myself and John in terms of not wanting to be entangled by the time I went public. Well, I mean, of course, I've been going public ever since, but you know, the book is the final step. But anyway, I can only be conscious of what I'm conscious of, so I can examine my conscious intentions and motivations and feelings as well as I can, but I always have to acknowledge that the deeper feelings are not conscious, and they're going to be informing what I'm doing, and they're going to, you know, once it's out there, it's too late. Others are going to see things that I don't, that I didn't acknowledge, right? So I'm not consciously out to get John DeRuiter. I'm consciously aiming to set the record straight, let's say, using a neutral term there, like I see, as you see around Cohen, a massively distorted representation of a man and his actions that is both dependent on and aggravating a kind of suspension of people's cognitive faculties. You know, people are in denial around John DeRuiter as they're in denial around Leonard Cohen and Hollywood and everything, really, right? But you've specific.
It caught up in some kind of, it's a trance or a, what do they call that in, anyway, I've forgotten a lot of English, you know, since living in Greece. But anyway, so just mesmerized and fascinated, and they're caught up in a wonderful feeling, you know.
Yeah, which is what Hollywood offers, and it's really what gurus generally offer, even though they're claiming to be offering the opposite. They're claiming to be offering reality, but what people don't want reality. People want these dissociative trance states in which they will get to feel like children again, but without all of the distress of being children. Like
Transference, that's the word I was looking for, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And having an authority and someone to model yourself on and look up to. And
right. So, and that, I think that's a very key thing, that if people are modeling themselves after this or that figure, whether it's DeRuiter or Cohen, then they're doing themselves a disservice. You know, they're distorting themselves, contorting themselves into ways of behavior which are not going to be suitable to them. So then you could say, I don't want to get too lofty, but it's something of a public service to, or a community service, to point out, if the emperor has no clothes, just say, hey, look, I can see his wang there, can't you see it? You know, therefore you're imagining these clothes and then fashioning your own outfit, you know, after this imagined thing. That is different from the desire to take somebody down, but it's also, it's not really separable from it, as in, if I was successful or you were successful, it would take this person down. It would take them off their pedestal.
Right. If we succeeded in our
yeah.
evil plot. Well, I don't know. I see the appeal. You see, I don't know DeRuiter. I never met him. I have a sense, from what you said about him, of course, I have a sense I wouldn't have liked him, but maybe I would have, you know, maybe I would have fallen for it. Maybe I would have felt really magnetic attraction, flattered to be in his presence. I don't know what goes, you know, I don't know what goes into all that. It's all those things, right? Just being able to get close to someone who seems to have power, and, you know, you feel wrapped up in it and so on. Mm. But I just have this feeling, you know, with Cohen, for sure, I get the feeling all the time that if he hadn't had this unknown dark side, it's mostly unknown. It would come through in flashes. I mean, he played on it in the you know, in much less so as he got older, of course. But when he was young, he played it, and people were drawn to the dark side of him as much as they were to the light. I mean, he always was very glib, and language came to him, and he was brilliant, you know, in interviews all along, but in terms of having a moral core or something that people felt profoundly wise, things coming out of him, that wasn't going on so much when he was young. It was more like he was a performer and a trickster.
Mm.
But without that, and he knew things that other people didn't know, and he had a way of talking about them without talking about them, and it was always like he was hooking people with something unknown, and I think that was part of them, you know, that was a big part of it, was the mystery around him. And the sense that he had done dark things, he knew about the underworld. That, I think, without that, the sage would just, you know, he would be boring. He would have been overlooked, I think, just if he just came across as a sage. But what he comes across as is something quite, you know, it's a much more interesting mixture of you know, dark and light.
Hmm.
And I think people are just, I think it's actually legitimate to be drawn to that, because I think it's a way to figure things out, figure yourself out, figure out the world, figure out how things work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's where I would sort of start with him. That's why I accept him on some level.
So, well, that's It's what you're saying now, what I'm hearing is just that Leonard Cohen's, what he had to give to the world, or what he still has, his legacy, is incomplete without the dark side.
Absolutely, I think absolutely so. Yeah,
Hmm.
I think that's really what people. I think people said, "Oh, they." I think they almost pretend to like his avuncular father. You know, that's because he's gotten old, and you have no choice. You have to accept that he became an old man and couldn't get around much. He used to say, "Don't get around much anymore." You know, back years ago. But when he was young, he certainly got around, and. I think people, you know, it's like a sort of sexual hunger, you know, that you project onto someone, you know, it's not the nice stuff really that is that you learn from, you know, you we're curious about people's ugly behavior or the things they can't talk about, the things they have to hide, you know, we're drawn to all that. So I think that's always worked for him. I mean, I found he got boring after a certain age, much more boring. I think I always found him a bit boring, but he got more boring as he got older and nicer. At the same time, I don't know, there was no one like him, so.
Well, I think, I mean, the risk of reducing it to a platitude that it's not about goodness, it's about wholeness. And
Yeah.
so if you do what Cohen did and what Derrida did and what all these Hollywood celebrities do and what public figures generally do, and because there's a whole Jungian principle behind this, the shadow and everything, if you put the good side forward in such a way that you can persuade people that that's the whole thing, then you. The only way to really do that successfully is to fragment yourself, to compartmentalize. Like
Right.
it's going to affect you and your own interiority. It's not as though you can pretend to be all good while living a secret dark life and not be split yourself. If you see what
Right.
I mean. Like I think Derrida and probably Cohen too, I think he managed to rationalize in present tense, he manages to rationalize the concealment and the deception because he believes that he's doing a positive service for people and that they wouldn't benefit, they wouldn't trust him if they knew the whole truth,
Yeah.
right? And therefore, he's doing for their own good, he's concealing the shadow stuff. That's, I think, the rationalization, but I think it's a lot, you know, it doesn't hold up because of what we said earlier, that people end up trying to imitate the good that they see, but it's only a fragment.
Oh yeah, and people do it, you know, and in terms of, well, people are usually not very good at imitation, you know, it looks like an imitation. It's like mimicking. It's
Yeah.
not things being, you know.
Yeah.
And it would be very hard for anyone to be Cohen without having done all the things he did,
Right,
you know.
exactly.
And part of what his talk is about is it's concealment, but it's also revealing. So it's kind of like a use of, well, we talked about that, I guess, long ago. But you know, metaphors that sort of reveal and conceal at the same time, and so you just get you get pulled in. I mean, you feel that, you know, you feel he has a secret life. Well, he also has a song that says he does.
Yeah.
And so on. He always seemed to have a secret life. Well, the thing about me in terms of what I've been up to is first of all, stumbling on and then trying to find out more about the secret life, you know, which at this point has pretty much, I think it's been eliminated. I think anyway, that's something I want to get into because I think they're attempting now. I don't know if it's him so much as it is his handlers and promoters and hangers-on and all the people, you know, who sing his songs and listen to his songs. So they are the ones that would like to divorce. They'd like to cut off the bottom part and leave only the, you know, above the belt stuff. They talk about him now in very saintly terms. He's like your friend, you know. He's a sort of a perfect man, or he's something, someone we should emulate his wisdom and so on. But I found it much more revealing, and I have more, you know, frankly, I have more respect for him than I did a few years ago, because now I know a lot more about what he was actually dealing with. And I'm a little nervous about it all because it really ends up, it's not so much him, in my opinion. I've felt this way for quite a while now. It's not so much him, it's the background. I think we even talked about this before. It's like, Cohen is a lot more interesting when you know the whole background. But I find that almost nobody knows the background. I don't know if anyone knows the whole background. I mean, I think I glimpsed parts of it, but putting, I'm not gonna use imagination and so on, intuition to fill in the blanks, because, but I have been at this for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I do, you know, I think see it. I think I can kind of see his childhood too now. And, young, when he, up until the point, you know, when he started to become known. And part of that is having gone into his papers recently. I haven't gone fully into them, but I've gone through a chunk of the first, there's 40 boxes of his archives,
mm-hmm.
University of Toronto. So I've been through three of those twice now. Not everything in them, but I've kind of been, you know, reading and skipping along and digging things up. And it's not, again, it's some pretty shocking things in there, or things I didn't expect, you know. Or things I didn't expect, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to become a bit controversial, you know. There's already stuff that's gone missing, as I was telling you. Since I mentioned it on a blog, I found that the poems I found that seem to describe satanic rituals have disappeared. I mean, I found those by accident. That's how I usually find things out, and it's by accident. And I happened to pull out a folder, and I found seven or eight poems in this I decided the more revealing folder, as I had 20 minutes left or something in the library before they closed, probably the most revealing thing I could read were the outtakes, you know, the discards from one of his early books called Spice Box of Earth. And there they were. Mm-hmm. So I said, discards. I said, oh, that'll be interesting. Mm-hmm. What he couldn't publish, right? Maybe they weren't good enough to publish, or maybe there was some other reason, I thought. So I start going through them, and sure enough, I find like a series of poems that seem to describe satanic rituals behind McGill on Mount Royal at night with children and people having their hearts torn out of their bodies. I mean, living people, you know, being dismembered and things like that. I found, I mean, it was in the language of metaphor and so on, and, but nevertheless, that's repeating. It just repeated. So that you, it's very hard to ignore, you know, to think, well, okay, when he wrote these, he was, what, 22? 20, 21, 22? Where did he get this stuff? And then, you know, it was time to leave the library. I left. I didn't have time to copy anything. I didn't have time for anything. So I know those poems existed. And I read all of them, and I made notes on them and so on after. But they're gone now, because I went back 6 months later, which was a couple of weeks ago, and I looked, I scoured all of those files of discards. There's not one left of those.
And you had mentioned it in your blog in the interim.
But I had written about it in my blog. Mm. I'm pretty sure I know who has done this. I'm pretty sure it's his website, someone at one of the websites who's seems to have taken over Cohen's legacy. Seems to become the main interpreter of Cohen's legacy. And he's at it all the time. He's just absolutely, you know, tireless. Mm. And anyway, I could back that up. But, you know, there's reasons why I think so, because actually something was published by a woman who went in and went through the same three boxes and seemed to boast about having... Anyway, I think that's what happened. I think they're trying to suppress... information that would lead people to ask questions that would then lead to people thinking like me, you know, instead of like the way they're supposed to think.
Right.
So, long story short, I mean, I think the truth about Cohen is he started rising in the world of literature and, you know, later music and so on because of his talent, but also because of joining a secret society. And then there was a kind of a logical process of that that happens to people who join secret societies. I found this time, although I did go back and I couldn't find those poems, which were the most graphic and and they would have shocked people, I think, if people had been able to read them. But now I don't think anyone will see them. I suspect, I don't know how they did it, but they got them. Oh, they've hidden them maybe in other folders. I don't know what they've done, but I did find other things that back up the idea that he did, definitely joined a secret society, and it was probably the Masons, and, you know, and it was at McGill, and he had contacts and so on, professors who were cultivating him and their wives, and he joined a whole social scene, and they were involved in ritual abuse after hours, you know.
So this is something you found more recently, you mean?
Yeah, this is something I found 2 weeks ago. I have them, I just typed them up. We can't really access them right now, but they're, well...
So you weren't able to make copies, you mean?
Couldn't make copies. They really were debating. Anyway, I was in there 2 weeks ago, and there became a whole debate over whether I could make copies or not allowed to because of copyright. And then they told me I could make a scan. I could make scans, but I couldn't photocopy. Then they came in and said, no, you can't make scans, but you can photocopy. This was right towards the end. But meanwhile, I had just copied them out by hand while they debated it somewhere.
It's not as good as evidence, though. What? I mean, if you could take photographs of them or something, that would obviously be more...
That would be illegal.
You're not allowed to take a camera in there, no?
Yeah, I do it illegally, but I didn't, you know, obviously I wasn't equipped to do that. But also, someone shouted down for me from one of the stacks, and, you know, this library goes up several floors, and he said, oh, you'll have to speak to Robert Corey. He's the one who will decide. Leonard's manager, Robert Corey, and then the children, Adam and Lorca. It's their decision, which is true. It's the estate that will decide whether unpublished poems can be published, right? That's really logical. But then I said, well, do I have a right to quote them, or is there fair use? You know, what is? And they didn't really have too many answers. So it's a very There's also a novel he wrote, which I read much of. It's pretty awful, called Ballet of Lepers. It's very strange stuff that he wrote when he was first attempt at writing a novel. Very autobiographical, very revealing of a really kind of corrupt world that he was involved in young, 20, 21, I don't know. And, just I don't think it'll ever be published. It's sort of disgusting, actually, to read some of it. It's not, I didn't find it funny.
And what evidence did you find then about the Masonic society? Like, how clear cut is it?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking if I showed these to you, you might say, oh, well, this is ambiguous and that's ambiguous and we don't know. But I would say consistently, I've got about, t I think I copied out about 10. And consistently, well, there's an image, he has one that's all about a man in his trophy room. It's just, my interpretation is this is someone who has joined an organization that he's going to keep him busy for the rest of his life, going through all the rituals and so on. He's going to collect a lot of, well, this is how I saw Leonard. This was my personal image of Leonard, is that he was someone with a vast amount of knowledge that he'd from many different religious spiritual traditions, that he really kind of he had that all assembled in his mind, and he had a grasp of all of these things. And that, so this person is a trophy collector in the poem, but he's saying maybe this is not the purpose of life, or it's certainly not the afterlife. It's going to keep me busy. I'm going to have a lot. I'll be successful in this world, but I won't. But maybe that's not the purpose of life. I mean, this is my interpretation of of what the poem's about. There's just a lot. I'll put it together at some point.
Have you considered doing a freedom of information request for the documents?
Well, they're all available to the public now. His papers?
No, about the CIA or whoever you think would have confident classified documents about current or previously classified.
Well, that's an idea, yeah, because people have done that for Dr. Cameron, recently. I saw. Yeah, I thought it actually has come up, yeah. Well, I think they do have. I wonder if you can. Yeah, that's what a good idea. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is even pre-CIA, but not re actually,
Not
this
really, no, I mean
pre-60s. No, it is the CIA. It is that period of the CIA. But it's known that the CIA had a cult in Montreal, operating out of cafes, recruiting young people. The Process Church was there. I used to meet the guy on the street, or pass by, and he'd be selling Process Church magazines. He wore a black cape. He ran a cafe. Leonard used to go to that cafe and play, on, at least outside. I have a photo of him,
I think that's the first time you mentioned the Process Church in context of Cohen.
Well, I'm not saying he was a member, although the daughter of the maid says that he was. She knew him. I think she knew him a lot better than I did in many ways. He told her things. But anyway, but definitely he was around town. 1969 was when the Process Church was quite visible in Montreal. And my informant tells me, who's a journalist, he's been talking to one of the key figures at that time, who anyway, who's now arrested, who was arrested for pedophilia in Thailand or Cambodia. Anyway, he's told me that he's been told there were rituals in the houses, there were people being sacrificed and murdered and so on, in wealthy houses in Montreal. And I've heard from someone else that it was well known that there were ritual murders going on Mount Royal in the cemetery, and that the cleanup crews from the city would come and just clean up the mess after, the morning after, and that it's kept very quiet. And that's what, those are the kinds of things that seem to be in those poems, those kinds of details,
Right. Was this backtrack a sec then? Who was your first source? The guy who talked about a pedophile in Thailand? Just some
Well, that's a
specifics
guy.
there.
Well, John Stahl is his name. He might be still in. He was then extradited or something, or he's back in California. But he had broken his parole, or his, and so he was back in jail in California about a year ago. And someone sent me information about him. Just because someone wanted to know, find people who might remember him, and they said, well, he's the guy you know, he ran this cafe called the Op Cafe, 1969. That I never went to. But then he said he used to be in the Process Church. I said, oh, that's the guy that used to sell, you know, he wore a black cape. He'd sell Process Church magazines on the corner, downtown corner in Montreal. And as a student, I walked past him two or three times, you know, over a few months, I'd see him, and I sometimes stopped to talk to him. And he'd try to recruit me, basically.
Right. Sounds dull, so I just found him online. And who was your source? Because you're speaking very quickly about lots of facts there. So you said that you had a source who mentioned John Stoll, but also mentioned that these ritual murders were going on in the bigger houses. Who was that?
Those are two separate people, yeah. And one of them is just someone who began to write to me recently who had known Cohen and the group. Says he met me, but I don't really remember him. And he just began kind of telling stories, some of that I didn't know. He knew Cohen. He knew, I don't know, if Henry Moscovich was a poet friend of Cohen's who was in the Allen Memorial, who seriously schizophrenic and who threw himself off a bridge at one point, survived, but he heard voices all the time. He was a good friend of Cohen's, and there was a group like that. So this person who wrote to me, whose name I don't want to give, but anyway, began just remembering or telling me things he remembered, and one of the things he remembered was that it was well known that there were rituals going on Mount Royal behind McGill and that people were killed.
Mm.
And that it involved the cross because they would reverse, you know what I mean, the kind of satanic reversals. They would congregate around the cross and then they would commit various kinds of lewd acts and ending sometimes in murder. And people, you know, and then he said the Italian city cleanup crews, meaning it was a group of Italians that were the cleanup crews, would arrive in the morning and be, you know, horrified and traumatized and so on, and then they would clean it up and everything was covered up.
Right.
So he had, you know, he had details on it. I didn't prime him for that. He just came up with it, you know, and I said, well, you know, it's similar to the kinds of imagery you find in Cohen's early writing, some of it, the unpublished, you know?
So the article, you sent me this link a while ago, but the one about John Stahl, a very brief one about him being arrested in Cambodia for pedophilia, you've commented in that article because somebody, Megaforce Media, asked for information about whether he was involved with the Process Church. So, do you know who that is, the Megaforce Media?
No, I don't know who they are. It's a bit familiar, but I don't know who they are.
Yeah, so somebody else is obviously researching this. That was last year.
You see that when you go on Google?
Yeah, it was a Google search for John Stahl Process Church, but it took me to the article I'd already had open because that's the main one about John Stahl and pedophilia, right? But yeah, there's a whole bunch of comments, and this guy, Megaforce, asked if anyone has info about whether he's involved with Process Church, please write him, and then you've responded to that June 3rd, 2016.
Okay, yeah. Well, I know for a fact he was, because I recognized him from the younger photos that were shown to me, because there was a series, and I mean, he was unmistakable, and he's kind of had this rock star, you know, look about him that you didn't forget, and he was, I remember him, and other people corroborate that he would sell the Process Church magazine. He always dressed up, as I say, in the silk cape, you know, looking the part of a Satanist.
Mm-hmm.
But baby, kind of very beautiful face, you know, kind of, what do you say about that? Yeah. Beautiful looking guy.
Right.
And so definitely he was selling it. I remember him opening it for me and showing me 1969, and I think he had that was a beautiful glossy magazine, you know, produced out of London, and I never bought it, but I would say, I don't have $4, you know, that's a lot of money. But he showed me the spread on Charles Manson when it came out. You can still find that online.
So this was in 1969.
Yeah, definitely. I would have been summer, I would have been strolling along, and there he was, and, you know, wink at me or whatever, and I'd say, oh, I'm interested in Hermann Hesse, and I'm reading Siddhartha or Steppenwolf right now, and
How old were you in 69? How old were you in 1969?
18. You know, taking literature courses. And
And that was before you met Leonard.
well, I had actually, you know, I'd seen him. I didn't personally meet him till 77. I didn't talk really talk with him, but I'd seen him. I'd been in a cafe, and he, you know, in 68, where he'd kind of been there in the audience, and there was a little noise made about that, you know. And so I'd seen him. I'd spotted him, and used to see him in a certain bar that I would drop into, and see him around town, you know,
Yeah.
numerous times. So, but 69, he was around, maybe not so much because I think he was touring quite a lot at that point. Yeah. And maybe living in New York mostly. But anyway, there is a photo from 68, I think, of him sitting on this, in front of the Op Cafe with his guitar playing, and a few people are standing around. So he was in and out of town.
You definitely got your work cut out for you, because there are thousands, millions of people even who would believe at the drop of a hat that Leonard Cohen was involved with satanic rituals and MK Ultra and all the rest of it. But those people, I don't know if they really count for much, because they kind of believe it with, you know, sort of across the board and indiscriminately. They just believe that the world is run by Illuminati Satanists, and that's kind of the end of it. So they're just looking for more fuel for their belief system, you know. And it may be that they're right, the world is run. I know that you more or less believe that yourself, and I probably do too, at least every other day of the week. But so I'm not sure if there'll be much achieved by just presenting evidence that kind of audience can use to consolidate their belief system. It seems that what you're confronting and what you're confronted with is the mainstream that rejects all of that out of hand, and that the first whiff of that kind of stuff that it gets, it uses as an excuse to reject all the rest, right? So what happened with this guy on Facebook was that he heard from another guy there about Leonard Cohen and the possibility, the rumors, or whatever we're going to call it, that he was involved in other stuff. And then he went from one link to another, and then he ended up at your blog very quickly. And then he read your piece about Paul McCartney. He thought, oh, well, this is one of those nuts who believe the Paul story, which I personally don't think is nutty, but you know, I can understand why people do. And then he read the piece, and then he got to the thing where you say, as a teenager who learned hypnotism, one of the techniques the CIA was exploring for use in mind control, and hypnotized the family maid in order to rape and torture her. Years later, he would rape and torture her daughter. It became the muse for his most relentlessly covered song, Hallelujah, and to whom he boasted of being a CIA agent and 33rd degree Mason, as well as John Lennon's real assassin. Well, right there, I mean, you've got the most
Yeah.
massively inflammatory charges, and they're not cited. There's no book note, there's no footnote, you're not naming even, and you're stating them as facts. You're actually stating them as facts that he tortured this, you know. So I mean, without getting into the I don't want to make this about criticizing your methods and stuff, because you're going to do what you do, but you could see how that's going
Said
to
it's book, Jason.
what.
I would say that in a book, but I might say that on a blog where I'm making another, argument, and that's, an awfully condensed, and it sound and I realize and sounds crazy,
It does.
but the fact is, given the time, which we don't have, every single one of those things I can back up with a source and a, and or at least a witness to some of it, but also there's just that's the whole thing. The problem right now is assembling all the facts and do I even really want to make a factual case? I mean, is that something I'm gonna real is that really what I'm aiming to do?
Right. Well, I think that's the
I don't
question.
think it is actually, but I'll do my best, at doing that. But in fact, every single one of those points I think can be, I don't know. Substantiated to some extent,
To
anyway.
some extent, but
So I don't know to what extent
the
until I.
fact, I mean, the fact, this is obviously an interesting thing. I mean, you and I, we're sort of diametrically opposed in many ways, as even though we're both the same star sign and we both agree about all kinds of stuff, but certainly our methods are diametrically opposed in terms of you rely on intuition to an enormous extent, and I rely on logic and deduction and all that. So it's a very male-female sort of dichotomy. But so naturally, your methodology, which is more intuitive, is a lot more risky. It's also more suited towards fiction. Obviously, if you're writing fiction, you can be as intuitive as you like. Obviously, you at the at present, you're not writing fiction. You're writing these reports about Leonard Cohen, and they're presented as if they were just a list of facts. But from my point of view, as as a logical person, well, a fact would be somebody has said this. Somebody claims that Cohen raped and tortured her. That's a fact. That's the fact. The fact isn't that he did it. That's a really essential distinction. And for, as I say, for a certain kind of audience, as in the people who have already drunk the Kool-Aid of Leonard Cohen, the sage and the saint, and the guy who just made it through talent, that whole narrative that you're attempting to break open, those people, you're giving them a really easy way to dismiss everything you say. And I think I don't think you're doing that consciously, is why I'm bringing it out. I don't think you want that to happen. I think you do want to reach those people too. So
That's
then I think that
a
there's a sort of.
question. I'm not sure I do, but I'm not sure I do want to reach those people.
Well, then who are you trying to reach? Because, as I say, the people who already believe that the whole system is run by MK Ultra Satanists, well,
Those are the people.
yeah, but so why? I mean, it's not going to change their perspective in any way.
But I think it could deepen. I think maybe. Well, you know what? I have quick answer to this, or I don't really know the answer at this point. I would think about what you're saying, but I already know what you're saying. It's partly to do with time. It's partly to do with the way I work. I'll read massive amounts of stuff, and I'll hear, and then things tend to then support what I'm reading, and information comes to me sometimes from multiple sources at once, and I have no, it's almost like I don't know why that happens, but it happens. So I guess that's called intuition. You know, then I have so much that I can't possibly, I mean, go back and backtrack and say, where did I get that first citation? I can do that, but I don't get that kind of time in my life, at least up to now. So what I end up doing is like Ronald Reagan, you know, how he was great at taking complex subjects and turning them into little fairy tales,
mm-hmm.
turning them into little homilies and so on, or little he told little stories. That's what I do. I tell a little story around it. And I think my main focus tends to be emotion, so rather than intellect. But that doesn't mean there's no intellect going on there. It just means that what I tend to express is the concentrated, you know, whatever the constant, the kernel of it as I see it. Now, I understand that sentence you just read to me is not something I would put in a book, but I might put it on a blog, because I was really talking about something else, I think. I was just trying to make a case for Leonard not being, having a whole background that no one's heard of, and that likely people will never, you know, very, if they never hear it, you know what, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think what he worked at most was exactly what I'm doing, which is taking an amount of experience that, you know, if you talked about it, you'd just be a total bore, because you'd never end. The way my stories do tend to go on and on and on, because I do take in a huge amount of detail, right, when I'm learning about something. But try to convey that in a concentrated form. What's the essence of it? And the essence is contradiction in his case. And he was constantly, I think, constantly working to put down the dark side, to keep it down, and to draw something out of it that he could feel was morally correct to communicate to an audience. It's like he was, you know, he was sifting, or what's the word, boiling, you know, boiling it all down, distilling experience, which was beyond, you know, belief in a lot of cases. I mean, Sylvie Simmons said it the other day too. He lived an incredible life you cannot even describe. She was given the task of trying to tell his life story, but I mean, she told part of it, but you could not describe the life he led. And so you know, he was constantly translating what his experience was into something that he could give the public and feel he was not doing bad. Because I think his aim ultimately, I think that's as a person, I think what he really aimed to do was to offer something that would last and that would help people. This is the conclusion I've come to after all of this. But in the process, and it's like, you know, the alchemical, like converting dross to gold or whatever, you know, garbage, trying to work, you know, taking blackness, and, you know, and turning it into a diamond or whatever, you know, just... That's what his aim was. That's what he was doing in his art. And so I think, you know, I have to give him that. but there was a lot that went into that. It was a mountain of, you know, slag. It was a heap of slag that went into the process that ended up with something quite crystallized, you know.
Hmm.
I think people get a good message from him. I think they are. I think I just figured that out today, actually.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, you're all over the mat right now, so...
He never footnoted. He was not a...
Yeah, yeah, but he's writing poems and novels.
He's a poet.
You're doing journalism, essentially, I mean...
Well, I'm doing memoir.
Yeah, but you weren't there when he raped and tortured the family maid, if he did, so that's not memoir. That's reportage... it's aspiring to be reportage, anyway.
I really disagree that's just reportage.
You're reporting something that you think is a fact.
Because of having, yeah, that, you know, some people will make a statement, it's just a flat statement, and you can go and you try to verify it and not verify it. But when someone gives you, as this woman did, gave me the full picture, multifaceted picture of her, of what she knew of him based on her experience. And in a completely non-linear way. And so when I said, "What was your mother's name?" You know, and she told me, "Stella," right? I didn't know, and neither did she. I had to go search for that, and I only found that name like a few weeks ago.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a compelling story.
If someone's giving you full spectrum, kind of total picture of experience, of chronology, but coming in a nonlinear way, you know, that's not coached. That's just, they're talking about their life. And it has full coherence for them because they lived it. So it's all coherent to them. Doesn't sound coherent. And then you can go to someone listening, but you get the, you know, you especially get the emotional, you know.
Well, this is the story here. What you're telling now, this is the story, not what Cohen did to the maid. It's you interacting with someone else who's had their personal experience of Cohen and is wrestling with it, and it's very charged. You know, there's trauma, and they're trying to convey it, and then you're picking up the charge, and then you're trying to convey it, and the charge is getting passed, and then you pass it on to people who read it as well. Like, even just writing about rape and torture, like, in a very snappy way is going to trigger people, never mind saying that Leonard Cohen, you know, the hero of millions, is a rapist and a torturer. That is so emotionally charged.
No question.
It can't really not backfire.
It can't do what?
It can't really not backfire in some way, I think.
Well, people will dispute it, or they'll say that couldn't happen, but, you know, the more you look at it, then you dig into the papers.
No, they won't. They'll stop digging. They'll stop looking, is my point. They'll stop reading. They just won't be interested. Because, A, it's too disturbing, and B, it's not backed up and it's not credible. So then, of course, they're going to be wanting to dismiss it. So then you give them an easy way to do that. So, you know, what I'm inviting you to consider here is that it might be, as in the case of when you went to the Montreal Library and you looked at these things and then you put them on the blog and then they disappeared, there might be some unconscious behavior on your part that's causing a kind of self-sabotaging.
But there are saboteurs.
Yeah, I know, but you alerted them, you tipped them.
Yes, I know, but, you know, in a sense I did that as a test. I wasn't actually that surprised.
Well, then it was a test that backfired because you've lost credibility as a result, again, because you could say this, but now you can't back it up. So, you know, we all self-sabotage. We do it on a daily basis because we're unconscious, but particularly if we're victims of trauma, as you know, then a big part of that, if it's organized trauma, or directed trauma, is that we're programmed to self-sabotage, to act in certain ways that will tip our handlers off to what we're doing or what we're discovering, so that then they can step in and damage control.
Well, I don't care, because they tip their hand. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, since I couldn't document it because the library closed and I couldn't come back the next day. Mm-hmm. So it was set up that way. That's how I look at it. I mean, I know you look at it differently, but I look at it as this was the setup. And I guess what I could have done was not say anything for 6 months, go back when I had and was able to get back and copy it all and then bring it out. But I don't think that would have done anything. I don't think that would have been better.
Why not?
Well, A, because they left out some stuff. They didn't get it all. They're not that smart. And number two, you know, they missed a few. And number two, all right, you know, let the graphic, you know, there. I suspect those poems are in the files somewhere and will be found someday.
Well, maybe, but I mean,
I don't think anyone physically can sneak pages out of the library. I mean, I wouldn't have attempted it.
But where we are in the present is where we are in the present, which is that you've got some very interesting testimony, but unfortunately you can't back it up. So
I can let that go, though, because there's so much more.
Well, sure. I'm not telling you shouldn't let it go.
The fact that I blogged about it, and now I can say, well, I blogged about it, and I described those poems. Now, if you go there, you will not find anything. There's about 7 or 8, I think.
Yes, but we only have your word for that.
Well, if you go, you're not going to find those poems. Well, the blog is a sort of a proof, because I detail the imagery that's there. It's now missing.
It's not proof of anything because you could have made it up. I mean, you're not really getting it because,
I am.
like I'm an ally, so you're talking to somebody who does believe you and does support you, and I do want to help you get your message out there. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing a podcast. So I don't actually think you're crazy, but I can certainly see why people would, and that something like this is only going, that just adds fuel to their own perception of you. And you could say, well, you don't care, but I mean, being strategic and learning how to be strategic is just part of developing one's tools, I think. It's not about not letting go or lingering in regret or anything like that. It's just like recognizing the ways in which that we're being manipulated by our own unconscious patterns, and how that does serve our handlers.
Well, I think you can flip it. That's just where I disagree with you. I think you can flip these things.
How
And I
so?
think that, you might call that a disaster, but I'm not really sure what my strategy would have done. I could have published, I could have found a way to copy those things, taken them out. I still wouldn't have had permission to copy them, to publish them. See, I would have been probably denied permission by the estate, by Robert Corey, who would have wanted to see them, and then he would have said, well, no. So you see, I don't really see, look, when I look at it, I don't see that that much was lost. But what did happen, which I think is very interesting, is that someone came in and took them. So that tells me there's people watching, there's people who know what's at stake here. They're not always so smart that they do a good job, and because they left a few, right? So the ones I didn't tell them about, they didn't get. So I just look at it that way. I have no choice, really. I have to look at it that way. Plus, I'm still in the process of figuring out a way to tell my story. Now, people said, like, I wrote The Man Next Door, and people said, well, that's crazy. Someone said, she's batshit crazy, right? That's fine, some people said, well, it's a narrative, and you don't find many, it's a very gripping narrative. That's more like along my lines of what I hope, right? And the narrative really depends on the energy, and it depends on the reversals. So this story of those missing poems is just another reversal that sheds light on who are we really dealing with. And I don't expect them to go down without a fight. I don't even expect them to go down, frankly. I'm much more like down,
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. And I would say that the aim isn't to bring them down, bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier. The aim is to set the record straight. And I think to do that, we need to ground it. We really need to ground it in evidential testimonies, logical arguments, even just for ourselves, so that we can bring it from the realm of this affect and intuitive sense and, sort of amorphous awareness of something into more or less a grounded factual description. That to me is,
I don't think we'll ever get that.
well, we can get closer to it, otherwise there's no point in doing it.
Well, because I don't believe it'll ever. I'm not even sure. Like I said, we don't have to go around and round in circles. But basically, facts are not my. They are, but they're not really what I deal in. I mean, I'm very sensitive to facts, and if something's not true, I'm very, I eliminate it. But I know some things. There are many things you can know you can never publish. That's one rule of journalism, right? You can know way more than what you can actually say in print. Number two, you get people telling you things that are absolutely, they'll tell you, they'll pour everything out to you, and you'll get it all, and they'll say, well, you can't use that because I'll be killed, or, I don't want the consequences of that. So then you have to throw that out, and then you have to what, find another source. Well, sometimes there is no other source. So you're left with what you know and looking for a way to communicate what you know is true. In the case of this woman, whose name I won't mention, who told me about her mother, the maid, well, we had something going for days, And then eventually she said, I'm not, you know, she blocked me on all her everything, Facebook and so on, and said I was a demon, and, you know, and said that the FBI was tapping her brain and that they read Leonard Cohen's book through the mail, that somehow they, with x-rays, when I sent her, you know, the book about Leonard Cohen and so on. And she just, you know, she's absolutely useless. She mm-hmm. became absolutely useless as a source.
Right.
That I know. And I really, I didn't provoke, in my opinion, I didn't provoke her. I really was trying to be very, you know, I was trying to go at it properly and very calmly and not, you know, and I was trying to, whatever. But, so I've seen that sort of thing happen. When you're dealing especially with a level of things that I would call satanic, maybe you don't, I don't know if you do, but you have to deal with fragmentation and you have mm-hmm. to deal with all sorts of extreme emotions and fears and so on. So that's just part of it.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, on the other hand, during the time where we spoke, we were filling in parts of each other's lives. I mean, you know, we essentially our lives were templates that fit one on top of the other with perfect, you know, precision. And so what I knew that she didn't know, what she knew that I didn't know, and the time frame, I was much better on dates than she was, but I could fill it all in. Mm. And I could recognize that everything she told me, she had never read a word about him. She knew nothing about him from the official. She just knew him personally. I could recognize that every fact that she pulled out of was not coming from books, was not coming from newspapers or anything. It was completely coming from her subjective experience, what happened. And so that was a sort of a check, you know, that was a way of verifying it, because she had no way to know these things. They just happened to be true. So,
right.
But in the end, she used to touch the whole thing by saying, you know, you're evil if you publish this. So.
Right. But the thing of corroborating facts,
yeah,
was
I argue with you, Jason. I'm only just kind of giving you an alternate picture, you know. I agree with you, everything you're saying.
I'm not sure if that's that's strictly true, whether you agree with me or not. Maybe part of you agrees with me and another part doesn't.
We can't be each other. We cannot. I can't duplicate what you do and you can't duplicate what I do. I can't. You can give me all the advice you want about writing, which I already have absorbed that years ago. I was a journalist, right? I never reached the point where I was doing a certain type of journalism. I was doing things that were much closer to poetry, if you want to say. I mean, I was using the abilities that I had, which are not equal to your abilities, right? But they're not, and certainly, definitely not analytically, or, you know, but I just never developed those skills. I never even wrote a research paper when I was in university. I went into creative writing and I somehow managed to write and still get A's and so on, but I wasn't following, you know,
I mean, I'm proceeding on the assumption, which you've questioned already, but that you would like to be credible.
I'd like to reach people with a message, but it may not be. It may be not the sort of message that, you know, you would consider credible.
Well, right.
And I'm not sure that I want to be credible. I never really cared about that so much.
Well, then, I mean, it doesn't. You're not making any sense, because you're trying to present a picture about Leonard Cohen that is sufficiently compelling as a narrative to undo people's previous version. And so, even as a fiction writer, one has to be credible. One has to create a fiction that's credible. So, but you're not writing fiction. So even you can say that this, you're working more intuitively and you're aiming for a larger sort of truth than just mere facts, which of course I would question, but anyway, you can say that, and that could be fine, but you still want it to be credible. You want it to be credible as a presentation of facts, because if it isn't, like if you were to mix with it, if you present a series of facts and then you just put something in that you made up and it's very obvious, that would undermine the whole structure that you've created, don't you think?
That's a very different thing. Making up stuff is very different from telling truth that you can't back up
with. Well, you don't know it's truth, though.
I do.
It's actually lying. If you're claiming that you know that something is true when you don't, that's what sloppy, that's yellow journalism.
No, it's not into, it's not because I would never say something that I couldn't back up factually.
But you can't back up Cohen torturing his maid. You already said that your witness became
No, I
useless to
can't
you
back
to
that
them.
up.
Huh?
But I have victim and witness, the Wayne's daughter. Now, some people would consider that a credible person, right? She heard it from her mother. She has a whole life
It's
that's
still allegedly,
around this,
it's still
and
an
all of this is
allegation.
completely coherent and makes complete sense. If, you know, thing about it is, all right, credibility, you're talking in terms of not getting sued.
No, I'm not. I'm talking in terms of actually making a persuasive case. Like when we overstate our case, we undermine it. So if we make claims that the evidence doesn't really back up, rather than just letting the evidence speak for itself, then people stop looking at the evidence because they say, "Well, this person's nuts," or "This person's exaggerating." That's what happens. That's what I learned with Occult Yorkshire,
My
you know.
life, I've been hearing all my life about Cohen doing these things to women.
Yeah, so that's your testimony, and that's valid. Like that you've been hearing, but
Yeah.
that is to say, that's, I mean, a memoir is quite different than
Thing. In his own papers, in his own files, in his novel, unpublished novel, he writes about it. I mean, he wrote poems about dismembering women
yeah.
in hotel rooms. So if you're, you know, got to see the whole thing, not just pick on that one, you know, that one testimony, that one story that you may or may not believe, but it's one of many.
Right, so that's a way to proceed is to put all the testimonies together and let them speak for themselves and say, "Well, look, I don't know. You know,
Right.
I never saw Cohen do this, but this is how he was with me. And look at all these different testimonies, and what do you, the reader, think?" That's very, very different than appearing to be somebody who's already made up their mind about Cohen and wants to, you know, blacken his name, which is how people do perceive what you're doing, some of them.
That's okay. I'm only getting going. I mean, I haven't, you don't. Anyway, I'm only getting going. But also, the thing is, I don't intend to blacken his name. I intend to make people aware of the background. And you know, if you really want to know what I'm doing, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to blacken the background, or actually shed light on the background.
Right.
I think he had no choice. Just we want to move on a little bit. Like, I think he had no choice.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Anne Diamond, and next Wednesday the 15th you can hear part 2 at horticulture.com/liminalist. I don't know about next podcast, possibly highlights from the next Liminalist Live Meet, which is scheduled for this Sunday the 12th of November. I'd like to thank Steve and Calvin for donating this week. I'd like to encourage people to check out the forum where I'm doing a little bit of posting and participate there if you feel like it. I realize it's perhaps a bit out of date, the format mode, and definitely not mobile friendly. I hope to get that updated, sorted. To encourage participation, discussion, communal activity somewhere other than Facebook, which I use only with great reluctance. Okay, Liminalist, goodbye. Thanks for listening between the podcasts.